You're listening to the Speaking Tongues podcast. I'm your host, El Sharice. Each week, I sit down to a conversation with multilinguals where we discuss and celebrate language, life, and culture through our own perspectives. Episode 75, speaking German, Dutch, Russian, and Polish. Hello, language lovers. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Speaking Tongues, the podcast in conversation with multilinguals. This week, I'm so happy to bring you this conversation with Dr. Timothy Douglas of Lancaster University, where we talk about his languages of German, Dutch, Russian, and Polish, but also about his background as a researcher and how languages have played a role in his scientific career. Timothy talks to us about his journey through Slavic and Germanic languages and how a biomaterials conference that he attended in Poland was a turning point in realizing that languages could impact his field. He talks about appreciating the subtle differences in the Slavic languages and how he's been able to keep from confusing them with one another. He tells us about the ways that languages can be used in the scientific community to build rapport, and that there's value in learning a language, even though it's often underrated as a soft skill. Dr. Douglas and I talk about the trouble with collaborating in English as a native English speaker, and the reasons why will most likely surprise you. We also talk about parallels between researching and language learning, as well as knowing yourself as a researcher and as a language learner. And he gives us his opinion on how he thinks the scientific community can promote multilingualism. Thank you to Dr. Douglas for this insightful and thought-provoking conversation, weaving language with science. If you enjoyed this episode of Speaking Tongues, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review the Speaking Tongues podcast on Apple Podcasts, or like and subscribe on YouTube so that other language lovers like ourselves can find the show. And if you've been a longtime listener of the show or even a recent listener, you can now support the show on buymeacoffee.com. Links to all platforms are in the show notes. Okay, let's chat. Welcome back to another episode of Speaking Tongues. I am here joined today by Dr. Timothy Douglas. How are you today, Dr. Douglas?
Oh, thank you very much for such a warm introduction. Please feel free to call me Tim or Timothy.
Okay.
Thanks very much for having me. I enjoyed the podcast that you've done, and so I'm glad you found me an interesting object of research.
As of course, I'm so happy to have an opportunity to talk to you today about your languages. And I like to start each episode with the same question, and that is, what is your first language, and which languages have you learned to speak?
Right. I'll answer both your questions. To be honest, I've become very good at avoiding both questions for the following reasons. So the first question, which was my native language, I grew up speaking English in a monolingual environment in a part of the United Kingdom called Northern Ireland. I've become good at avoiding this question because often I didn't want to give people who spoke other languages, information that I could speak English, because I wanted to speak their language in their country. And then when they replied in English, when they found out I was from, I would just feel like a foreigner. You see what I mean? And regarding the second question, I became good at avoiding this because I really never knew how to answer it. So I would wonder, when people mean speak, how well do they mean? Do they mean fluent, whatever that means, or perfectly? And also, because I had learnt more than one or two, I wasn't sure how to give them an answer that was honest and complete and short. And but if you'll permit me, I'll give you a long and honest answer now. I started, like many British school children, learning French as my first foreign language at school. Then as my second, I learned German. And German was the first language that really excited me. I liked the sound of it very much. And it had a certain logical feature that French didn't, because I would never know how to pronounce French words when I saw them. But when I with German, it was so much easier. And so I kept on studying this language at secondary school. And then at the end of secondary school, I started to learn some Chinese. Then I went to university and I went on an exchange year in Germany, and that was actually a turning point in my language sort of learning journey, because it wasn't an academic subject anymore that I learned in the classroom. It is something that I was really using to, you know, make friends with people and just to live my life. And it was really, well, exhilarating, to be honest. And from a language point of view, the offer of languages in Germany is much wider than in the United Kingdom. In the United Kingdom, in general, you may learn some Romance languages like French or Spanish. Sometimes Italian might be offered. Usually German is offered, although I understand that's on the decline now. But in Germany, you have the whole spectrum. You have, you know, the Romance languages, you have other Germanic languages, and you have Slavic languages as well, which really interested me. So I started to learn Russian there. And when I finished my studies, I studied in London, I thought to myself, I enjoyed studying in Germany and speaking German so much more than studying in London. So why didn't I go back to Germany and keep studying? And so I did. And there I continued to live and in Germany. And I started to learn Dutch, because it was like German, but funny. And then I started to learn Polish, because it was, you know, like Russian, but funny. And then later Czech, because it was like, you know, Polish but funny. And other reasons, I started to learn sort of Italian as well, and a little bit of Finnish. And then I after many years in Germany, I moved to the Netherlands, where I was then very glad that I had learned some Dutch. And then I went to the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, which is the northern part, for several years. And then I returned sort of to the United Kingdom, but to a place that I've never lived before in northern England. And so it's actually a nice feeling, because I spent so many years living abroad that I feel like an exchange student again here. And the United Kingdom seems, you know, very exotic to me, like, you know,
right.
Like a foreign country, which is, but I like that, you know.
Mm-hmm. So tell me, when you grew up monolingual and you've studied all these languages, when did it go from being just something you were interested in to something that you really wanted, something that you really had a passion for, something that really became a big part of your life?
Right. Well, I think it was when I did a student exchange in Germany. And then I really sort of understood how nice it was to live a language. Another point in my life was when I was, you know, doing my PhD in Germany, and I took part in my favorite scientific conference, which is the Polish Society for Biomaterials Conference, which takes place in southern Poland every year. One thing I like about the Slavic peoples is that they really, you know how to have fun. And I remember that they're also, you know, very, you know, hospitable once you get to know them. And I remember the first time I went, it was in 2005, and I didn't speak Polish very well then, but, you know, they were reacted very, very positively, you know, to my efforts to speak it. And then from then I started to realize, well, subconsciously, I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but I started to, you know, appreciate the value of, you know, using languages, you know, to make sort of connections with people, and that you don't have to speak, you know, a language well in order to, you know, touch someone. And this, you know, gave me, you know, an extra stimulus to, you know, keep on learning. So I thought to myself, it's not just something that I enjoy as my hobby, but it's something that I can really, you know, make a difference in my career as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what was it about, what was it specifically about Germanic languages and Slavic languages that grabbed you?
Right. Well, I liked German at school because it made more sense to me. Why I preferred Germanic and Slavic languages, as I mentioned before, I found Dutch was seemed to be an amusing variant of German. I hope I'm not insulting any Dutch speakers by saying that, but the fact that it was similar to German but not quite, that sort of fascinated me. And also, I was interested in the Slavic sort of countries such as Russia, Poland, and the Czech Republic, because they have some similarities with Western European culture, but also in some ways they're also different.
Right.
I'll also be quite honest. There's a Dutch saying, "De vreemde eend in de beet," which means the strange duck in the ice hole, which means the duck in the hole in the ice, in a lake, which is not like the other ducks. And I like to be the one who doesn't fit in. I like to be different. It's really vanity, to be honest. And so I prefer, speaking learning languages that other people don't really like to learn.
Right.
And so I thought to myself, well, Romance languages seem to be very popular in Western Europe. But why not look at these other languages that fewer people learn, such as Russian, Polish, and Czech. And one thing that was also nice was when I went to language courses, and because they weren't as popular, the groups would be smaller, and so the teacher would have more time for you, and you'd get to know the other people in your course better. And above all, the fact that the people would react more positively to you, because they would say, "Wow, you're learning our language. We didn't expect that." That was part of the reward and part of the motivation for wanting to continue.
Mm-hmm. With all of these languages that you're saying they are sort of similar, but they have variations or they're close with one another. You have a few of them under your belt. How do you keep them straight? How do you not confuse them all?
Oh, how do I keep them straight? Well, to be honest, they're all crooked. But the good news is that as you become better at them, well, as I became better at them, they became less crooked. So I remember that when I started learning Dutch, probably about 50% of what came out of my mouth was German. I find that luckily the mixing tends to happen in one direction. In my case, the stronger language is not affected by the weaker language, but the weaker language is mixed with the stronger language. I remember also when I started to learn Polish, most of what I said was Russian, to be honest. And I remember driving my Polish teacher crazy because you can actually often tell how old a Polish person is by how well, if somebody is older than me, then he or she will generally speak Russian because they will have learned it at school under the communist, in the communist period. And, because Polish is similar to Russian, Poles can learn Russian, quite easily. For instance, I remember when I went to Moscow once for a language course, there were also Polish students there, and the Polish students were speaking rather fluently, whereas we from Western Europe were struggling to get a sentence out in Russian. But to answer your question about mixing, my Polish teacher was not older than me, and she had never learned Russian.
Okay.
So she found my mix of Polish and Russian harder to decipher, I think. And it was the same thing with Czech. I mean, I remember a compliment that I received not long ago, from my Czech teacher. She said, "Oh, when you started with me, you were like a half Pole. And now you're only about, one quarter Polish." So it happens, but I don't think it's such a big deal, to be honest. I'd rather learn similar languages and enjoy the similarities and differences between them. I remember one very famous polyglot called Richard Simcott, who you may have heard of, who's learned about 50 languages. He said that when you learn a similar language, you're not learning new things, you're basically learning differences, which I think is a nice way of putting it. And I, one of the things I like very much are the sort of similarities and some of the subtle differences, which this can, I mean, this can lead to some, you know, amusing incidents. So how do I keep them apart? Not always. I remember once, usually it's with Czech that I make the most howlers because I mix up languages. I remember going into a restaurant in the Czech Republic and there was a wonderful sort of smell. So I exclaimed very loudly, "To je výborný zápach," and people looked at me rather shocked. And I thought I had said, you know, "That's a wonderful smell," but actually I'd said, "Oh, that's a wonderful stink."
Because
this word zápach in Russian and Polish is neutral, but in Czech it's always negative.
Oh, I see. Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. Yeah. And another one I made the other day, I was talking about, you know, Moses McCormick, who you, I guess you, you've heard of, who spoke about 50 languages, and he loved going to these, you know, commercial centers in order to talk to immigrants. And I wanted to say that he went to look for immigrants, which in Czech would be on hledal imigrantu. But instead, I thought use the Polish word, which is on szukal imigrantu, which means something rather different. Which means he actually that he had sexual intercourse, you know, with the
Yikes.
With the so.
Oh, God.
But and looking back on it, it's all, you know, amusing. But this is actually one of the things that I like very much about these studying similar languages. Not just making progress quickly in them, thanks to the similarities, but also appreciating their subtle differences. You know.
Right. Yeah. That's really interesting. So in you are a researcher and you are in biomaterials.
Yes.
Right? Okay. In your career as a researcher, and in the scientific field, how do you notice that language has helped your career? You touched a bit on that before with what you said, how you were able to use these languages in your career, but how specifically do you see the advantage of being able to speak all of these languages in the work that you do?
Right. Well, I think that people sometimes forget that science is done by humans, you know, in collaboration with other humans. So everything that is good for human-human interactions, you know, is good for science. To give you an example, the field that I work on is you know, biomaterials. It's multidisciplinary. So basically, we're making materials that can stimulate tissue regeneration. So you want to make materials that can stimulate you know, cells to attach to the materials, to grow on them, and then produce new tissue. For that, you need people from different disciplines. You need people who can make materials, you know, such as me. You need biologists, you know, who can look at how the, you know, cells grow on the materials and how they produce of new tissue. Then you need, you know, vets. You might you would need doctors, you know, to implant these materials. So you have, you know, you can't do it all alone. You have to work together, you know, with other people. And people are generally more willing, of course, to work together with other people who, you know, they can relate to, you know, who they can understand. And I think, you know, this is where, you know, languages can play a role in, you know, building rapport between people. So if you can speak somebody, as there's a nice quote by Nelson Mandela, which is, you know, if you talk to a man in language he knows, that goes to his head. If you talk to him in his language, that goes to his heart. So Nelson Mandela understood the emotional value of speaking other people's languages. And there's another quote from the former West German Chancellor Willy Brandt, and he said, "If you are selling, if I am selling to you, then I speak your language, and if I am buying, dann müssen Sie doch Deutsch sprechen," which means you have to speak German. So he understood that people are more likely, you know, to do things for you if you, you know, talk to them, you know, in their language.
Right.
And this is, you know, in science, you know, we have collaborations. We don't, you know, we're not sort of buying and selling, but people are more willing to work together with you if, you know, you can speak their language. And they're more willing as well, you know, to send, you know, people to visit and do work in your lab if, you know, they think, you know, you have an understanding of their language and their culture and their, you know, way of working. Language is basically, you know, a soft skill. And because it's a soft skill that's not easily measurable in money, I think it tends to be undervalued. I think humans in general tend to underestimate things that cannot be easily and quantitatively measured. Because, you know, people are willing, if people are willing to collaborate with you, because, you know, they can communicate easily with you and because you can, you know, build up a relationship with them by speaking their language, you are more likely to help each other, which means that you get more results, you know, and you can publish more research results, and then you can, you know, gain, you know, more sort of grants and so on. So it does help a career sort of indirectly. And I think that, to be honest, I indirectly owe my position now to the fact that I can speak, you know, Russian and Polish and Czech not so well, because I was able to have those collaborations, which led to the output that helped me to, you know, get my position here now.
I see.
Yes. Yeah. As an academic, I always have, it's a lot to say about things, but another, you know, way in which language can benefit use of science, I think, because it makes you better at communicating. One thing that I've noticed is that native speakers of English are not very good at speaking English as a lingua franca. So at scientific conferences, ironically, often they are the most difficult to understand because they speak too quickly. They use expressions that would be easily understandable for somebody from their culture, but which are not typically expressions that non-native speakers, you know, would learn. Sometimes they use slang, culture-specific references.
You know, I actually read something recently that said that the problem with English, and English native English speakers is that we use too much jargon, and we use too many, like you said, too many phrases that make sense to us, but to someone who's learning the language, they either may not encounter these phrases, or the phrases are regional. And so maybe outside of the United States, you know, people in the UK or in Australia or India or South Africa, they may not use these specific terms. And it can be difficult even for us as English speakers to, you know, understand, you know, what an Australian person might mean by something, or what an Irish person might mean by something else. So then how can we expect people who are learning English to kind of understand all these regional differences with English and all these different sayings that come from different parts of the world?
You just reminded me, I was always, as a child, when I was watching American films, I had no idea why Americans would want to put gas in their cars, give an example.
Right.
Only much later did I realize that you were, you know, referring to, you know, gasoline.
Yeah.
But I completely agree with you. And I suspect that if more native English speakers had, you know, learnt other languages, they'd be able to put themselves in the position of non-native speakers, you know, more easily. And also, you know, the better that you can communicate, the more attention people are going to pay to you, the more likely they're going to want to collaborate with you, etc. You know. Mm-hmm.
So do you think that scientists and the scientific community, what things do you think that they can glean from linguists and from multilingual people in terms of how they conduct their research, how they work with colleagues around the world, how they, you know, how their studies and their research is informed?
I mean, that's a good question. I mean, we've already touched on two ways in which knowing language can help you. It can help you to, you know, make collaborations with other people, and it can help you to speak English, you know, better as a lingua franca. I think that most of the value in language is due to the you know, the better soft skills, which are often, you know, useful for a scientific career. One thing that I think you need to be a good scientist and to be a good polyglot is to be curious. So, you know, you have to be curious about, you know, other cultures and other languages if you want to be a polyglot. Equally, if you want to be a scientist, a good researcher, you know, you have to be curious about things and be open to new things. And what I think would I also, I'm surprised that science is a very, you know, international field, that you have people from a whole range of countries, you know, doing science, and people in the scientific world are generally appreciative that, you know, you can speak their language. So they do value that. But from the scientific community as a whole, there isn't a real drive from the community to encourage people to speak many languages. It's expected that everyone will speak English, but nobody is saying, okay, let's try to learn several languages because then we can collaborate better and then get better results. Mm-hmm. There's not so much of that, which surprises me.
So I'm curious if, you know, this is an international community and there are researchers, professors, et cetera, all over the world. If you're someone who's doing research or doing a specific study, and I really don't know this, and it popped into my head as we were talking. If you're publishing a paper, let's say, and your language is whatever, how you publish the paper in your own language, how does that get disseminated? Like, how do other people read it? Do you have to find like a scientific translator? Are papers and you know, journals and things like that, are they regularly translated? Like, how does this research reach the whole world if you know, someone's language, let's say, isn't English or isn't, you know, I guess maybe one of the most popular languages spoken in the world?
That's a very good point that you bring up. Unfortunately, a lot of research won't be read, you know, if it's not, you know, in English. Most of the, you know, the major journals, certainly in my area, you know, are, you know, in English. So it's expected that people will be able to write in English and then submit manuscripts in English. And as you can imagine, some people will find English easier than others. So that could also mean that people from certain countries find it easier to publish than, you know, people from other countries. Also, a second disadvantage is there can be good research that is done in other countries that doesn't reach the audience that it should because it isn't in English. So for many years, you know, Russian scientists, you know, would sort of publish, you know, in Russian, but they would publish in their own Russian language journals, which didn't tend to be sort of disseminated beyond the former Soviet Union. And it's very good work, of course, but it's not easy to get access to. And then, of course, you have to speak Russian in order to, you know, read it in the original. That is changing. I mean, more people from Russia are starting to sort of publish in you know, English-speaking journals. To answer, in short, I mean, if you don't publish in English, you're unlikely to reach an international audience. And but that doesn't necessarily mean that English is necessarily the best medium for, you know, for science. I mean, the strength of English is that being a lingua franca, more people can understand it, so you can reach more people. But the weakness of English is also the fact that it's a lingua franca. It's impersonal. And if you can speak it, there's a tendency to say, oh, yeah, so what? But if you would, you know, collaborate with somebody, you know, in their own language, you will often find they are much more receptive.
Right. With Natakelam, learn a language, change a life. Did you know about half the world is bilingual? Bilingualism provides tangible social and professional benefits. But did you know it has even been linked to slowing dementia and cognitive decline? Feed your brain with a new language. Learn to speak like a native with Natakelam's tutors from displaced backgrounds. Speaking Tongues listeners get a special 10% off on all languages with the code SPEAKING10 at natakelam.com. Natakelam, learn a language, make a friend, change a life. Are you saying that potentially, if someone does research that could change humanity as we know it, but they happen to publish it in a language that not everybody speaks, this research could go unnoticed and unrecognized? Am I making that assumption correctly?
Well, it's something that could happen. I suspect that if somebody thought that their research had the potential to be a major breakthrough, that they would also take time and effort to have it translated into English.
Okay.
Right.
So there is a field of translation that works, I guess, with scientific studies and scientific documents.
Yes, I mean, because I've spent most of my career in Europe. So again, this is my sort of scientific translating is not my sort of speciality. But I mean, there are services that are offered by certain journals.
Okay.
That as an English native speaker, I've never had to use them, of course. Mm-hmm. But there are services offered to sort of improve, the quality of English of some manuscripts order to help to get them published, in these international journals.
Okay. Yeah. I had no idea. That's something that if we weren't having this conversation, I would not have even thought of. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even think that, there's a need for that, but it appears that there is. And now I wonder two things, and I hope I don't forget the second thing in asking the first thing.
Okay. But, okay.
I wonder if you've noticed among your international colleagues, do they feel pressure, or do they feel a push to have to learn English in order to get their research published or to collaborate with other scientists?
Well, certainly to get their research published, yes. And also in order to be able to understand, the scientific literature, you do need to have a passive knowledge of English at least.
Hmm. My second question is, I'm thinking about the United Nations and how there are official languages of the United Nations that I guess everyone who's a part of this committee knows some of these core languages. Is there something like that in the scientific community?
No. I mean, it's sort of, English is used as a lingua franca, and it's expected that people who take part in scientific events will be able to speak English. Mm-hmm. Again, my message to everybody is that English is not necessarily the best medium of communication to use, because you can't connect as well with people with English as you can with other languages.
Right.
And the other thing I would say is that if you are interested in languages and other cultures, then a career as a scientist is great, because people from all over the world are doing science, and you have all these chances to collaborate with people from a country that you're interested in speaking a language that you like to speak. For instance, I think that Moses McCormick, for instance, who spoke about 50 languages, he would have loved, scientific conferences where you have, people from all kinds of countries and you always have something to talk about, which is, you know, the science that you're interested in. You know, people will give, you know, presentations at conferences, your oral presentations. There were also lots of poster presentations. So there's always something to talk about and in a language that you can speak. So right. In that way, I'm very lucky that in my career, I can combine my interests in science and languages.
Mm-hmm. That's really amazing. As a language learner, and the things that you've had to learn, and I guess the kind of discipline that you've had to have in order to learn the different languages that you speak, what are some commonalities, I guess, you can think of between going through the motions of learning a language and, I guess, going through the motions of completing a scientific study?
You just reminded me of something. I mean, we already talked about sort of curiosity, how a good researcher is curious, a good language learner is curious. I think you also have to be tenacious, and you have to not worry about doing it badly. I think, you know, the key to speaking a language well is speaking a language badly, and speak a language badly a lot, and then you get better. And similarly, with doing research, the key to doing good research is to do bad research and do lots of it, and then you get better. So when you start speaking a language, you know, you're not so experienced, and so a lot of what you say will not be understood, because not because you can't speak the language in principle, but you're just not there yet because you don't have the experience. And sometimes you don't really know, you know, what works and what doesn't work. In research, it's a bit like that as well. A lot of the experiments that you do won't work. And that's not because there's something wrong with you, but it's just because, you know, sometimes it's just bad luck. You know, otherwise it wouldn't be research if you knew that it was going to work. But it's important that, you know, you accept that, and then you learn from that, and then you understand that by, you know, doing lots of experiments and lots of research in a way that isn't so good, you'll end up doing research in a way that is better. Mm. And another important thing is you have to try to get to know yourself as a language learner and get to know yourself as a researcher. So one thing that I've learned since I became aware of the language learning community, you know, online, and, you know, that's how I learned about your podcast, is that you have a very wide range of, you know, learning styles, and lots of different people are being very successful in their own specific way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's the same with, you know, doing research. You know, everybody has their own specific style. Some people are good at doing some things, some people are good at doing other things. And I learned that in my case, what I was good at doing was actually building up these collaborations in order to where everybody, all of the collaborators would, as the Dutch say, you know, hun steentje bijdragen, so contribute their little stone to build something. And through that, by, you know, we ended up, you know, with some, you know, some good, you know, research results. And I was able to do that actually thanks to actually my language skills. So without the language skills, it would have been much more difficult to have, you know, built up these collaborations. So that's what I'm good at doing.
Mm.
But of course, there are many people who are, you know, more successful than I am, who have, you know, wildly differing styles as well. So that was quite as a, you know, a good scientist should be able to sum up things concisely. So in short, you know, don't give up and get to know yourself and what works for you, both as a researcher and as a language learner.
Right, right. Conversely, what are some things that non-scientific people can take from a scientific method to apply to their language learning?
Right. Well,
does your question that I first asked, does it flow both ways? Or is there something that can be learned from science in language learning that maybe language learners haven't really considered?
Right. Well, I think the answer that the, your last question does flow both ways, but I'll try to add something. You know, there are different types of, you know, of science, and there's also engineering where you're trying basically to apply science to solve a problem.
Right.
Now, in certain disciplines like maths or maybe physics, you have to be right, but at least in languages, you just have to be right enough to be understood. So I wish to encourage language learners, your discipline is often, you know, more forgiving than ours. However, you know, if you look at it from an engineering point of view, you know, in engineering, you're trying to apply your knowledge of science in order to solve a problem, you know, to get what you want. And also in language learning, but, you know, you are trying to do something similar. You know, you're trying to understand, or you're trying to get your point across, or whatever. But, you know, in engineering, you know, there are lots and lots of different ways in which you can tackle the problem, depending on your, you know, your own knowledge, and to what degree you want to, how well you want to solve the problem. But, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. It just has to be good enough for you.
Right.
And I would look at it the same way in language learning. You don't have to speak a language perfectly to get the results you want. You can speak a language very fluently and still make lots of mistakes. It doesn't matter, you know, if you make mistakes, as long as you do with the you achieve your objective, you know, with the language. It doesn't matter how badly you speak, as long as it's good enough for you.
Right.
And I hope this doesn't sound the wrong way, but it doesn't matter how bad your engineering solution is, as long as it's good enough for the client, or right, good enough for what you want to achieve.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's really valuable. And as we're talking about these cross-disciplinary fields, I think that it's useful to think about how, you know, especially with science, like science is all about figuring things out and getting to the bottom of things. And I'm sure there are things that can be learned from different disciplines, even within the scientific community, that can help someone who's learning a language. And maybe they don't know how to approach it, or maybe they're feeling discouraged and they're looking for a new method. So thank you for explaining that.
Well, I'd also like to encourage language learners. I think in some of the concepts in science, I think are much more complicated than those in language learning.
Of course. I mean, I have to tell you, I never did well in science in school, and it was never something that I find science interesting. When someone else does the research and I can read about it. But I did not enjoy chemistry labs, and but I love reading about physics, and I think engineering is really phenomenal. So
yes. One just suggestion coming back to chemistry, I mean, in the periodic table, you know, there are, if you look at the names of the elements, there are usually a linguistic story connected, you know, with each element. So right, for instance, the symbol for gold, you know, is Au. And we think, why is it Au? But it actually comes from aurum, which is the Latin word for gold.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, because I know you know Romance languages, you know that you have the oro in Italian, or mm-hmm, or in French, you know.
Yeah.
Another one that's quite interesting is, you know, helium. Mm-hmm. Actually comes from helios, which is the Greek word from the sun. Mm-hmm. And it was actually by analyzing the solar radiation that the element was discovered.
Okay.
And also it's actually, you know, the periodic table itself. In Russian, it's called Tabela Mendeleev. Is after Dmitry Mendeleev, who was a Russian chemist who made some alterations, you know, to the periodic table, you know, and improved it during its design.
Mm-hmm. I was always fascinated. Well, I took Latin in high school for 4 years. So I think in my high school chemistry class, I was way more interested in the periodic chart, because I recognized all of these Latin names in the names for the elements, and that the etymology always grabbed me when it comes to science. And I always enjoyed lead is PB.
Yeah, plumbum.
Yeah, and I always thought that was like, you know, that was probably the start of my rabbit hole into being interested in etymology. But I also, scientific names of animals always, I always find them so exciting because it usually will tell you the most basic thing you need to know about the animal. And if you understand the Latin or the Greek where it comes from, it's usually really funny. Like, I can't think of the names, and I'm going to think of it later, probably by the time this episode is out, but the Latin name for skunk translates to like little smelly thing, or like, and I can't think of what it is right now, but hopefully someone listening will tag me and, you know, let me know what it is. But I mean, I'll look it up, but if you're listening, just let me know anyway.
Yes. Well, talking of animals, it's interesting that, you know, a lot of the words for animals in English have sort of Germanic origins. So for instance, we say a cat would be, you know, a Katze in German, or, you know, a pig would be ein Schwein, which is like swine. Interestingly enough, a lot of the meats have French origins, like, you know, boeuf, which is beef, or pork, which is, you know, pork in English.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting how these things come about. And I have to do another whole episode on that, I think.
Well, I think it would definitely be, you know, worthy of, you know, several episodes, a whole, you know,
a series
of podcasts,
yeah.
You know, not just on animals, but I think it would also be an interesting, what you just said about becoming interested in etymology, you know, via chemistry. That's a very nice story. And I think, you know, you should expand on that.
Yeah, I used to have a little periodic chart that the teacher gave out, and it was like wallet size. So it was like you just put it in your wallet, and I would just look at it. I never memorized the elements like I was supposed to. You know how you have to like know the numbers and like the weight and stuff. I could not care less. I was just more interested in the names, in the names and where they came from in Latin, and that makes me wonder, like. In your community, in your colleagues and people that you've met, do a lot of people understand Latin and Greek?
Right. Well, before I forget, to come back to your question about, you know, what scientists could learn from language learners, and you mentioned the fact that you weren't interested in memorizing or learning a lot of the names or a lot of the atomic weights or whatever. That I think is something that we scientists could learn from language learners. In language learners learn a lot of, you know, vocabulary and so on, and because, you know, you need the knowledge to be able to speak the language. You can't always, if you want to speak fluently, you can't think, well, I'll just look up each word when I need to. It has to be in your head. And I think you can benefit a lot as a scientist if you do have some fundamental knowledge, you know, in your head. So if you know the molecular weights of, you know, carbon and hydrogen and oxygen, for instance, you can do a lot of, you know, calculations, you know, much more quickly.
Right.
But to come back to your point about learning Latin and Greek, certainly in the United Kingdom, Latin is not really taught very much at school. So for instance, my father's generation, I think it would have been very common to learn Latin. In my generation, only a minority of you know, school children would have learned it. And the generation going to school now, I think very few people learn it. So most of my students have never learned Latin. And maybe if they did, the periodic table might help get them into etymology and get them into languages like you. But that's not, I think the link for most people between sort of Latin and Greek and science is not visible because they haven't had any Latin and Greek.
Yeah. Yeah. That's like, I think about that a lot. Like, I'm really lucky that I had that opportunity to learn Latin, and I didn't really get it at the time. I remember people would say, well, if you're going to become a doctor or a lawyer, or you're going to go into science, like you have to understand Latin. You have to know Latin, and because it's in so many words and so many terms and things like that. So it just makes me wonder, maybe not if students maybe aren't told that that's something that could be useful to them in their careers in medicine or science.
Yes. And this is one thing that I think was a shame about my language learning at school. I had some very good language teachers, but none of them ever explained to us how learning a language had really changed their lives. So it remained an academic subject because the link with other things was not made. And languages, I think, are like, if you'll excuse me using a very Anglophone metaphor, are like an icing on the cake. So lots of things, like science, in my opinion, run more smoothly and more pleasantly, thanks to languages. But languages are not something that are used in life just isolation for the sake of, for their own sake. And I think what you're mentioning again with Latin, that resonates with me as well, because although I had some very good Latin teachers, they did not explain why Latin, was, useful for everyday life. Now, of course, there is a use because the Romance languages are descended from that. Many words in these languages come from Latin. Also, certain grammatical concepts like, cases, declinations, endings, all this is very relevant, for learning of German and for learning the Slavic languages.
Absolutely.
As well. Yes.
Yeah.
And so really Latin is a sort of an introduction to language via a dead language.
Right.
And some people actually, some school children actually prefer this. But when I was, I learned Latin at school for several years, but at the end, I still had no more idea why I'd learned it than when I had started. Yeah. So this is something that's not just true for dead languages and modern languages, but I think for practically all subjects that are taught at school,
right,
the link between how it can change someone's life and what you learn in the classroom is not made. And I appreciate, of course, that it's probably not easy. Otherwise, all teachers would be doing it all the time.
Yeah.
But if it could just a bit of that, because if an adult is sitting in the classroom and an adult wants to know, why am I learning this? And a child is no different. The child's maybe more willing to accept sitting in a classroom because he or she, well, just has to, and they're used to be doing what they're told.
Right.
But if there's one thing I could change about the school system, it would be just making the link to, things in the real world.
Yeah, I agree. I have a lot of feelings about that that will take up another hour of your time.
Right. Well,
next time we'll get into that. In your opinion, what do you think would be how do you think that scientists and researchers and the scientific community can promote multilingualism in their work, in their field of study? What do you think would be a good start? Maybe not what would be a utopian answer, but what do you think would be a good start to showing how valuable multilingualism can be to the scientific community?
That's a very, very good question. That's like the $1 million question. How could we encourage more people to learn languages in the scientific community? I think if it's going to happen, it's going to take a long time, because I think just on a low level, I think I wish people would more actively encourage others to learn languages. When I worked in Germany and I worked in the Netherlands and I worked in Belgium, I spoke the local languages, German and Dutch. Now, although this was appreciated, one thing that I never observed was people from other countries who maybe didn't speak German as their first language. I never saw any encouragement to learn the local language and speak it better, especially not in the Netherlands and in the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, which surprises me because in these cultures where so much emphasis is placed on language learning, people don't always seem to value the usefulness and importance of learning their own language. So because people, if you know lots of languages, languages are not just about pure transmission of information. They're also about interpersonal interactions as well.
Right.
So if you speak the local language, people will perceive you differently. Yes. But in these countries where the general population speaks English and other languages to a higher level in general, there isn't so much encouragement, at least not in the scientific world.
Right.
And I would say to scientists, please, if you live in a non-English speaking country, please encourage actively people who come to your group to learn the local language. I think anything that promotes mobility of scientists between different countries and exposes them to more cultures and more languages, that's also a good thing. I think that also just on an individual level, the best thing that we can do is just to learn languages and speak them as well as we can and as often as we can, and try to do as good science as we can, thanks to the collaborations that we make via these languages, so that hopefully, people will start thinking, that person has been able to build up these collaborations due to his or her language knowledge. Maybe I could do something similar.
Right.
So just a very slow change, just maybe influencing a few people through one's own example. And then hopefully somebody else will learn more languages, and then somebody else who watches that other person will learn, just, baby steps, at the start.
Yeah. I think that's a good start. I think it would help a lot of people in the community, in the scientific community, for sure. For anyone who's interested in knowing more or in reaching out to you, please tell us where we can find you or why we should reach out to you, or if there's any way that we can get in touch with you.
Sure. Well, I work at Lancaster University in the United Kingdom. So if you Google me at Lancaster University, you'll find my profile and my contact details. I'm interested in people who are interested in science, but also I'm interested in people who have used languages, not just in their scientific career, but also in other careers, because I'm very interested in how language can make a difference in somebody's life, for the better, even if languages are not the main focus of their life. So I know some people are translators, some people are interpreters, but many people, I think like myself, just do their career, but do it more enjoyably and do it more productively thanks to languages. If somebody wants to share their story with me, I'm very happy to hear it.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I want to hear those stories too.
Well, you have a podcast where you share a lot of extremely different, diverse and interesting stories. So I think it's only a matter of time.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Dr. Timothy Douglas. Timothy, thank you for this conversation. I really enjoyed learning from you and learning a little bit about what you do in your world in scientific study. And I like to end each episode with the same question, and that is, do you have any jokes, tongue twisters, cool slang words, idioms, words of wisdom, or words of advice in any of your languages? German, Russian, Czech, Polish, Dutch.
Yes, well, actually, one of the things I love about language is that how certain, you know, expressions are expressed differently in different languages. So you use the word tongue twister. Okay. Now in German and in Dutch and in Czech, it's a tongue breaker. So in German, it would be Zungenbrecher, in Dutch, a tongue breaker, and in Czech, Jazykolam, which means basically tongue breaker. But in Russian, you say skorogovorka, which means something that is said quickly. Oh. It's understood that it's not easy to say it quickly. And the Poles have a very nice expression, which is łamaniec językowy, which means linguistic contortion, because it's not easy, you know, to pronounce. Yeah, and I love this way of expressing the same concept in subtly different ways. But I do have a saying as well.
Sure.
One thing I've been trying to make clear in this conversation is that languages are good for science, and that sciences are good for languages. So you can as we say in English, kill two birds with one stone. As you know, the French also say that. And you know, in Italian, you say prendere due piccioni con una fava. So you take two pigeons, you know, with a bean. But in German and in Dutch and in Czech, it's hit two flies, you know, with a strike. So basically, zwei Fliegen mit einer Klappe schlagen in German. In Dutch, twee vliegen in een klapslaan.
Oh my god.
And in Czech would zabít dvě mouchy jednou ranou. So it's just hitting two flies instead of killing two birds. And in Russia, the Russians say, you know, ubít dvůch zajcov jedním výstřelem, which means to kill two hares with one shot. And the Poles have a really nice way of saying this. It's upiec dwie piecenie na jednym ogniu, which means to cook sort of two pieces of meat in one fire. So I love this, that how, you know, it's the same idea, the same saying, but it's expressed differently in lots of different languages.
Well, thank you for sharing those and those comparisons. It's interesting to hear the similarities of all the languages, and even the tone in which they're delivered changes as the language changes. So thank you so much for sharing all of those. Really quickly, before I let you go, do not think about this too hard, but in all the languages we were talking about today, and just the first one that comes to mind, what is the best way to say goodbye?
I'll choose Polish, and I would say, you know, trzymaj się, which means to take care. And I like in the it's interesting how different languages, you know, evoke different emotions in me. And when I speak Polish, I feel like a teenager, and and so I like being inappropriately informal all the time. So if I met the president of Poland, I would just say, "Oh, trzymaj się," which means like, take care, man.
Trzymaj się?
Yeah, trzymaj się.
Trzymaj się, Timothy, Dr. Douglas. Pleasure talking with you, and I will be talking to you soon.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me. Bye.
Bye.